Torquay, Saturday, 12th January 1974. Perhaps it might be worthwhile to consider today something of deep significance associated with that festivity and holiness of Christmas Day, which now has, of course, passed us by. Recall the words of Jesus, "Come unto me, all ye that toil and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Who is speaking there? We would all say those are the words of Jesus. What do we mean by the name Jesus? What does it convey to us? What does it convey to the man in the world? Does it not bring up a picture of an ordinary person in appearance with a body like ours, who ate and drank and slept like you and I do, who, it is said, shared the sorrows and joys of ordinary mortals, and who is regarded as, therefore, unlike us also? Does not that name conjure up a picture before our minds of such a person? And we make the mistake of feeling, imagining that that picture fits the living reality that was Jesus. We do not know that any picture conjured up in the mind in the ordinary way is but a mental construct of our own. Every one of you, for instance, can see me seated here, can see this recorder, this microphone. And we all think, and you all think, as you look at these, that you are seeing the thing, the person. What you are actually seeing is a mental construct in your own mind, formed by the impact of stimuli from me, from the microphone, from the recorder, and so on. Now, each person's mental construct is never true to the reality, because our minds are all heavily conditioned, and they're all conditioned in a different way, so that within the organism, when the brain raises up this mental construct, it is different from anybody else's mental construct. So the name Jesus, just as the name the Buddha or Krishna or the Queen or whoever it is, conjures up a mental construct in each person's mind, which is quite different in so many ways from the construct in another person's mind. And that is what we are really looking at. So we don't really know whom we are talking of or thinking of or believing in or trusting. When we use a name like Jesus or anybody else's. We must be well aware of this. Feel it as well as see it very clearly, coolly, with the intellect. See the fact of it, that this is what happens. And if you really see that this is what happens, then your warm living feeling, which makes for the living relationship between what was a reality 20 centuries ago and yourself, has some meaning and significance in it. Let us now try to look into one important aspect, at least, of that meaning and significance. Jesus is known as the Christ. In him functioned the Christ consciousness. This Christ consciousness, if you will recall matters which we have considered in this connection in past meetings, is the consciousness characterizing the Son of God. And the me referred to when he says, "Come unto me," is precisely this Christ consciousness which functioned in him, who had realized here and now and was the representative of God the Father, that he was the Son of God. This is a matter of consciousness, of understanding what takes place in consciousness. Recall also that this Christ consciousness is associated with the sixth sephira. In Kabbalistic teaching, the sephira known as Tifereth, which stands for beauty, harmony, justice, which stands also for equilibrium, poise, for the balance, for teaching par excellence, astrologically associated with the sign of Libra, also associated with Hermes Trismegistus. I mention all these associations because those of you who are interested and study these things might find them useful. Now, at this stage, the being has realized perfect egohood, which means perfect individuality insofar as that person as a distinct person in the world is concerned. Personality, in the true sense, has come to its complete fruition and fulfillment. This personality is no longer a false image of the reality, not an idol. It is a vital, living, pure thing, representing the true person. And you may recall, the true person means he in whom all evil-mindedness has been burnt out. We considered this in detail several times when we considered the meaning of that term in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, Purusha, the one in whom all evil-mindedness has been burnt out. And this is the meaning of full individuality, of perfect egohood, insofar as we confine that egohood to the individual. But in the case of such a being, that egohood is totally devoid of any egoism. It is totally devoid of any isolative self-consciousness. What does that imply? That individual is the perfect individual, not only in the limited sense of one human being in the race which we call mankind, the species we call mankind, but he is an individual in terms of the total reality. Individual means indivisible. If a person is whole and complete within himself in the limited sphere, then he is whole and indivisible in himself as a psychophysical organism. But if in consciousness he has become totally free of all selfness, then in consciousness, in mind, in pure mind, this transcendent universal reality which is pure mind, he is undivided from the whole, from totality, from transcendence itself. Therefore Jesus says quite simply, believe me, I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. And he says, I and the Father are one. And you see, these are very, very real meanings. This is our human destiny, if you like. This is the sort of purpose in view of the developmental process on the planet for us. The purpose of our existence is just this kind of thing. So now, he uses the term me, which is an ordinary personal pronoun representing a particular individual. But what other term could he possibly use? And it is by no means an inaccurate term in the context. You know how the Buddha constantly uses the word aham, I. Although ordinary, conventional Buddhist psychological analysis completely disposes of the substantial reality of the I. But you see, meditate deeply on these things, and you will see the light where the true meaning underlying this somewhat illusory and delusive words is concerned. So now, here is the perfect man in the ordinary limited human sense of the term, who had come to perfect egohood and transcended that egohood in terms of the perfect individual who was at one with totality. And this is all embodied and symbolized in Tifereth, that sixth sephira. Remember, Jesus was a Kabbalist and knew all about it. So he used correct language, as correct as was possible in his day and in his environment. Now this is the one who, constantly in touch with the transcendent, constantly at home in the transcendent, constantly in touch and at home in this world and with his fellow human beings, he spoke these words, "Come unto me." Now perhaps we begin to see the significance of this coming unto me. What is this me that we are all going towards? Cease to be enslaved by the mental construct we raise up in our minds with the name of Jesus. But awaken to the reality which that name and the word me as used by him implies, really stands for. And it is within us, ourselves. The Buddha said, "Look within, thou art Buddha." Jesus says, "The kingdom of heaven is within you, is among you." Some people translate it as among. Look within. And there you will find the living reality which has to come to fruition within each one of us, even as it came to fruition in the person whose name was Jesus. Come unto me. All ye that toil and are heavy laden, what do we toil for? What are we laden with? Consider this very carefully, because in this is tied up the tragedy of mankind. What do we toil for? Pleasure, possessions, security, excitement, sensational excitement, miscalled happiness. The gratification of the fierce electrochemistry of the body, miscalled love. Are not these the things we toil for? Look very carefully. Look very lovingly, with no self-hate or self-condemnation involved in it. Even when we, people like ourselves, earnestly, sincerely interested in religion, in the religious life, in discovering what is truth, and so on and so on, even we, if we are really mindful, if we are really awake to ourselves, we will find that we are subconsciously driven along the same lines as the sub-man of the world is. How many times a day do I wish that this, that, or the other were otherwise? Why? Why the reaction? Why am I unable to face it? It is too much for me to bear. Perfectly true, the organism breaks up under it. And it is not sensible or spiritual or wise in any way to deliberately cooperate with the destruction of the organism. Perfectly true. But look deeply. I am not able to face it because I don't wish to face it. I wish it were otherwise. Why do I wish it were otherwise? Because this which is here is painful, I don't like it, I don't want it, I reject it. But all rejection is the act of hate. It is here as an opportunity for enlightenment. In order that I may learn a lesson, a difficult lesson, perhaps so difficult that I will have to give up my actual existence under the stress and strain in order to learn it. But Jesus lay on the cross. How difficult it was for him to accept it, to understand it. But he understood. In that time, that fateful moment of truth, praying to the Father in Gethsemane when he knew what was coming, I can't do that, can I? Can you? So you see, we toil and moil and heap up burdens on ourselves, all for the sake of getting rid of our burdens, our sorrows, our difficulties, our unpleasant situations, and so on and so on. Out of compassion for the self, one does not cooperate with the destruction of the self. Out of wisdom with regard to the self, one does not refuse anything and everything which life presents to us as a challenge. And when life presents it to us as a challenge, we do not meet it in the common worldly spirit of something to oppose and destroy because it is in my way. It is presented as a challenge in order that this isolatively self-conscious, egoistic ego may become free of that and release himself into that fulfillment which life in its totality and in its transcendence is seeking to release out of each one of us. This is very difficult, not at all easy. But look at what we toil for. And if the vision becomes true, you will find that the unpleasant, the hurtful, somehow moves out of the way. Truth, the vision, compassion, wisdom are like healing balms. They are like solvents of the knotted situation. The evil situation comes back because, like Adam, I undergo a fall. Adam did not fall just one day. He fell every day. We all constantly keep falling. What is our fall? Supposing every one of us here, at some moment or other, has a glimpse, has a real vision, a lightning stroke, if you like, but a life-giving lightning stroke of transcendence. And then some other stimulus comes, and we are right down in the mire, licking dirt. That is the fall. Adam, where art thou? Said God. As if God needed to ask Adam where he was. Adam, at what level is your immediate attention, your immediate awareness, your state of consciousness? To what have you fallen? That is God within Adam himself saying it to Adam. I have the vision. I'm exalted and this, that and the other. Then I have the fall. And that other aspect inside me, the one, the transcendent one that fell, if you like, says to the fallen one, and they are both within me, myself, what have you fallen to? So look carefully. All ye that toil and are heavy laden, come unto me, and I will give you rest. Again, we are all deluded by that word I. Therefore, the whole of conventional Christendom looks to a particular person called Jesus, a construct in each person's mind, and a false construct, because that construct bears the complete imprint of one's own conditioning, and so on. One, Christendom, therefore, regards this person, Jesus, as some marvelous superhuman entity who will give rest to those who take their troubles and sorrows and lays them upon his shoulders, shirking one's own responsibility. But it is totally impossible to shirk one's responsibility. It is totally impossible to plant your sorrows and your difficulties upon somebody else. Why? Those sorrows and difficulties are me, myself. That's the whole point. I manufacture them. I carry them about with me. They constitute me. Supposing I were to take my fingers or my knees or my head or my ribs or something and plant them on somebody, there'd be no me left at all. That would be the end. You see the utter absurdity of it. And therefore, this I will give you rest, mistranslated as another being, as another person, never can give you rest. And then, when fate strikes hard, the brother you adored is killed in a war, or some ideal of yours, a construct in the mind, is shattered by the reality of experience, then one turns around snarling and says, Jesus has failed me, God has failed me. He never thinks, he never even wants to be aware of the fact, I have failed myself. Come unto me and I will give you rest. Who is speaking? What is speaking? Totality, transcendence is speaking. If you and I, who toil and are heavy laden, can get to the me represented by Jesus, it means that we have ourselves fully dealt with our responsibility. Completely transformed our whole being. We are free from slavery, abject, miserable slavery to our desires, our whims, our appetites, our passions, our particular conceptions of all the innumerable ought-to-be's in our daily life. This room ought to be arranged this way, the meals ought to be cooked that way, the miners ought to do that, and the government ought to do this, and so forth and so forth. If we are concerned with religion, in its essence, in the deep sense, we have to be totally free of the domination over us of reciprocity. Reciprocity flourishes in the realm of duality. There is no option to that. Where a social order is concerned, where the running of the affairs of communities composed of people as they are is concerned, reciprocity holds good. To put it in its crude form, the tit for tat principle does hold good. You can't get away from that. But if you and I are concerned with the coming to fruition of this transcendent reality in each one of us, we have to get beyond all that. Whilst living in the midst of the situation and the circumstance which is under the control of reciprocity. This is where the great problem comes. Now you see why the living of the religious life inevitably imposes upon us suffering. A suffering which we can never get rid of, and which we never should try to get rid of. Vicariousness is a fact of existence. If your friend, if your beloved, if your child, if the teacher you adore, or the servant who has been your faithful servant for the last 50 years, does you any wrong and so forth, do you not suffer on that account? There the wrong, the hurt is directly upon you yourself. But supposing any one of those people with whom you have had such close, loving relationship for such a long time were to fall into trouble, do you not suffer also with his trouble? Vicariousness is a fact of life. If I do some evil deed, my family, my friends are involved in it. They suffer. They also pay a penalty, don't they? We have to realize this. That is why we have to live in the world, not be of the world. In the world, in the midst of all the forces that prevent us from coming to that which is represented by the word me when Jesus said it. But supposing we do move unto that state of perfect egohood, devoid of egoism, devoid of separative consciousness, if we do move there, what is it that is realized? What is realized is rest. Peace, contentment, bliss. Something which is not given by another. to you, but which lies within the self, but which now comes to full flower because the obstructions are all removed. Now this immortal plant of life, which we know as humanity, the real human within one, comes to full manifestation and fruition in the world as such. And the whole world is redeemed and beautified by that. And this is rest. This is nirvana. The absolute peace, the absolute upekha. But do not think that this is the end of what we do not like. The end of what we think is not how things ought to be. Far from it. This is no retirement with a fine pension in one's old age. This is the state where there is action at last. Right action, pure action, true action. For this state of rest will imply the complete cessation of all toiling and moiling, heaping up burdens on ourselves, and our sorrowing and our suffering, and vicariously producing sorrow and suffering for all around us. And they likewise are doing the same in their turn. It means the cessation of all that. And when that fussiness, that busyness, that miserable activity comes to an end, then pure action is present. Pure happiness is present. Step out of your front door and look at the glory of the skies on a starlit night. See the beauty of the sunset. Hear the song of the bird. Watch that little toddler on the pavement laughing as he tries to run along. And can you prevent being happy? Look at the sea, calm and in storm. Listen to the majesty of the thunder and the rain as it falls, roaring away. Can you prevent yourself from knowing joy? Does not life in its naturalness, in its true naturalness, absolutely pour forth a stream of joy and happiness? So do we need to organize holidays? To toil and moil and make heaps of money? Anyhow, as the modern world says, make it anyhow. There is no ethical problem involved in it. And then squander it in destroying your life energy in the so-called organized holiday. But when it happens naturally, somebody who you love invites you, you invite somebody you know, somebody who needs, makes, and you make that person happy in your home, is not that the holiday of holidays? You see, our outlook, our attitude, what it is. I will give you rest, and that rest is full of bliss, of action, which is pure action, perfect action. How do we set about in the world solving the problems of the world? By plans, by making conditions which will bring us what we desire, what we feel and think is good. Do we know what is good? What an extraordinary conceit. It's a totally unwarrantable conceit with which all of us human beings are plagued, that we know what is the good thing, what ought to be, for the state, for the other fellow. And so we tear the petals of the rose asunder. We twist the mind and the feelings and the sweetness of the little one growing up. We stuff him with all kinds of misconceptions and falsities, condition him so that he will hardly have a chance of growing into a human being. He'll become a subhuman. But he will never know rest. Come unto me, all ye that toil and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. And this I, remember, is the totality, is transcendence itself. And this rest is the action, the perfect action of transcendence. And it is our divine destiny to be the instruments through which this can happen. Brood on these things. And the toiling and moiling and sorrowing might drop away by itself. And then every day will be like a Christmas day, the day of the birth of the Christ consciousness, the day of the emergence of enlightenment. How easily we pray of those who, as we commonly say, are dead, may light perpetual shine on them. But how much more wonderful if light perpetual continually shines out of each and every one of us. Do you not see Mother Earth ceasing to cry with the pain that is inflicted on her by me, by you, by all creatures who call themselves human beings? Do the trees and the flowers, do the birds and the waters inflict pain on the earth as we do? They don't. They obey the behests of nature. They are in tune with the laws of their being. We are not. And the fact that we are not is our great opportunity for learning how to become the conscious cooperators with the divine will, the will of God. To realize the Christ consciousness means supremely that thy will, not mine, be done is a realized fact. I, the ordinary mortal, live by the law of my will. Howsoever deludedly, hypocritically, I may say, oh no, I live to serve God and my fellow man. Thy will, not mine, be done. Even a Jesus had that as his great problem on the eve of the supreme day of his life. Thy will, not mine. Complete desirelessness. Complete freedom from all my toiling and moiling and burden bearing. Therefore. And then there is that sweet and simple reality which is perfect rest.